WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Let me just put it my perspective on this, which is, for me, this is a moment of constitutional vandalism like I've never seen in my lifetime. I swore an oath to uphold the Constitution, and we have a president that won't submit themselves to the checks and balances. He is undermining the ability for Congress to do its job and investigate. That was the line that crossed for me. I was not immediately calling for impeachment. I was saying, let's investigate after the Mueller report. But Congress hasn't been able to do their job.
Last week, on Monday, Senator Cory Booker came to the studio and we talked about many things. But top of our minds was, of course, the prospect of impeachment.
There will be a point in history where people look back on us and say, what did people do when the Constitution was under assault and being violated?
Just one day after we spoke, the political world changed completely.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. Therefore, today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
Speaker Pelosi's reluctance up until that point had been frustrating to Booker and to many other Democrats. But her motive was plain and may turn out to be extremely shrewd. Pelosi has felt all along that if the House began impeachment too soon and with too little public support, and it died in the Senate, as it still likely might, then Democratic candidates would suffer badly in the 2020 elections.
Politics be damned. This is a moment, a moral moment, that we should stand up and say, because the precedent that it sets is whoever, Democrat, Republican, future presidents, yeah, trash the Constitution and the checks and balances. And if the politics don't line up, you're not going to be impeached.
But politics be damned, even if it hands an election to Donald Trump.
I have more faith in the American people right
now. Do you?
Absolutely. And they've shown it in the 2018 election. Hell, they showed it in the first weeks of this presidency.
In the crowded field vying for the 2020 nomination, Senator Booker is looking still for a breakout moment, and he hasn't gotten it yet. He pledged not to take contributions from corporate PACs or lobbyists, and now his campaign is desperately short of cash. In fact, it could even fold very soon. But Booker is an accomplished candidate on the stump, and he's certainly not short on ambition. His agenda includes sweeping criminal justice reform and a $3 trillion climate package. He came up in politics as the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, a city that suffered badly from the loss of manufacturing, from abandonment, from poverty, violence, neglect of every kind. As mayor, he succeeded in revitalizing Newark's downtown, and he oversaw a drop in the notoriously high crime rate there. Then there was the time that Cory Booker rushed into a burning house and saved the life of one of his constituents. He seemed to have a knack for making the right move at the right time. I've got to ask you a question about a book.
Yes.
Long ago, the late Richard Ben Cramer wrote a book about a presidential campaign that on the surface did not seem to be the most exciting campaign of all time. And it's called What It Takes. And
yes,
the strength of that book is that through profiles of all the candidates and really deep reporting, you got a sense of what it really takes to run for president in terms of endurance, in almost the physicality of running. What has surprised you? And what can you tell us about that human experience of running for president, even in these early months?
Well, it is a physical endurance test, and it does reveal who you are and how you deal and what kind of campaign that you run. My political training, you know, there's an Oscar-nominated documentary about it called Street Fight. My political training comes from the roughest of rough campaigns. Tires on my car slashed, windows smashed, my phone's tapped.
You were greeted as an outsider by the kind of political machine in Newark.
Underdog. Yeah. I mean, everything imaginable against us. National political people coming to campaign against us. So this, to me,
reminded me of Barack Obama's attempt to beat Bobby Rush in Chicago.
It is so similar. Yeah. I hope people watch the movie because it is, you just won't think it's America, the kind of stuff we had to go up against. Mm-hmm. And it is such a great way to learn that it has to be retail, grassroots. And so much of this in those early primary states is about that. People want to kick your tires. They want to—
Anybody slashing them?
No.
But what's the experience? Obviously, you're not getting your tires slashed. But what is surprising you about the experience of running for president?
The goodness of people. Like we
don't get the opposite.
I don't. In fact, when I was walking through the Iowa steak fry as a vegan, and we put out there that we were not going to stay in the campaign if we couldn't raise money. I had people in other candidates' T-shirts saying, "Oh, I'm a X person supporter, but need you in this race, man. I gave you $5." And even my campaign team, we got together and said, "Corey, you know, the sentiment of folks is they don't want to beat Donald Trump. They would like to eliminate him from the planet Earth. And you're going to start this campaign talking about a more courageous empathy, a revival of civic grace." I still remember one of my favorite moments in the campaign is I'm going to the stage in Iowa to a big town hall. We're blown away by how many people showed up. And a big guy sees me. I'm a big guy, former tight end for Stanford, and puts his arm around me, thinks he's going to have sort of a bro moment and says, "Dude, I want you to punch Donald Trump in the face." And I look at him and I go, "Dude, that's a felony." and just said, "Sit down and let me explain to you why that's the exact wrong approach to beating Donald Trump." And I made the case on like I do in every town hall, that I know I'm angry, I'm hurt. But let me make the case to you that the way we have beat demagogues and bullies and fearmongers
is how. Michelle Obama tells us when they go low, we go high, and that was tried in 2016. And maybe that didn't work out so well. So where are you on that?
Well, let me just make you two historical points to you. The first one is about what sentiment wins. We didn't beat Bull Connor because we brought bigger dogs and bigger fire hoses. We didn't beat him because we demeaned and degraded him personally, but we had artists.
Is Donald Trump Bull Connor?
I mean, his brand of white supremacy, his brand of bigotry and racism that he's preaching from the highest office in the land, he sounds like more like George Wallace than he does George Washington. But remember, we beat Bull Connor by artists of activism who called to the moral imagination of this country and created, excited and ignited new majorities. And so you can go from how did we beat the fear-mongering of McCarthyism? We don't beat it by playing on their turf, on their terms, using their tactics. This president will not be beaten by us out nicknaming him or by demeaning and degrading. That's playing into the darkness that he's trying to drag this country in.
You grew up in Jersey about 10 minutes from where I did, and your town you grew up in was almost completely white, if I remember it well, pretty damn white. And you come from a family of first black executives at IBM. How did your parents talk to you about race in those particular circumstances at that particular time? And then how do you think about it today, what they were telling you?
Look, my parents were not in any way hesitant at telling my brother and I about the wretchedness and bigotry and hate in this country. When I was about to get my driver's license, I remember my parents having a conversation with me that I thought was, I made my normal wry teenage jokes, and the seriousness in their eyes and the fear in their eyes to helping me understand that I would have a different experience as, and it turned out they were predicted right, with police officers than my high school friends. But this is the thing
you predicted right. What was your experience?
Oh, my God. I couldn't come over with the George Washington Bridge in the 80s without being pulled over. I mean, this was the days that people used to go over to Washington Heights, buy drugs, come right back over. Right. A black guy alone in a car, pulled over all the time. Car surrounded. I can tell horrible, indignant stories. They're just walking into Jersey malls and being followed. My 20s have painful stories. But this is what my parents told me. They said, what defines us, not just as a family, but as a country, is not that there's bigotry, hatred, and racism. There's always been, but how we respond to them. You talk about me being the first black family in an all-white town, as my father affectionately called us, the four raisins in a tub of sweet vanilla ice cream. We got there because of white people who saw that we were getting turned away in town after town every time my parents in 1969 tried to buy a home.
In Bergen County, New Jersey.
Yeah. And so what happened? They found a group of mostly white people, some blacks, who met in a living room on the weekends and decided to do a sting operation. They sent my parents out with a volunteer white couple behind them. When my parents were told the house was sold or pulled off the market, the white couple found out the house was still for sale. In the house I grew up in, the white couple put a bid on the house, bid accepted, papers drawn up. On the day of the closing, the white couple did not show up in the real estate agent's office. My father did, and a volunteer lawyer named Marty Friedman, white guy, Jewish, and they marched into the real estate agent's office. And by the way, the real estate agent didn't capitulate. He stands up and punches Marty Friedman in the face and sings a dog on my dad.
Right. And this is not Montgomery in 1950.
No, this is New Jersey 1969. My parents fought violence and racism to grow up in my house. My parents told me that story, but they also told me the story about the good people who understood that patriotism is love of country, but you can't love your country unless you love your fellow countrymen and women. And love isn't sentimentality. Love is sacrifice, and it's service. It's saying that if your kids don't have a great public school to go to, my kids are lesser off.
This is a very hard question to ask, but again, it goes to the Obama experience in Chicago. When he first ran for Congress, he was running against Bobby Rush, who was a fixture of the South Side. He's still in Congress. Obama, came from Hawaii, he was living on the South Side, had been an organizer, a state senator, and he comes into Bobby Rush's district, and he is told repeatedly that he is, and it's a horrible phrase, not black enough, over and over and over again, and he lost by a big margin. You had the same thing happen when you came to Newark, and it wasn't just Sharp James saying it. There were people all over the city that were really hard on you.
Yeah.
In a city where, in my growing up, if I remember correctly, every mayor of Newark went to jail until you.
Yes.
Hugh Adnizio, Ken Gibson, eventually Sharp James.
Leo Carlin, going back even further.
Exactly.
Look, the reality is we had a hard-fought, close election, and our opponent used every possible imaginable tool. I mean, you remember on ABC TV saying this guy is a tool of the Jews. I mean, just remarks that, like, we found stunning. He's, like, using comments that were so objectionable. KKK member. Oh, the CIA planted him in our city. We know that that is a lever that many politicians have tried to use, including the president of the United States right now, to try to divide people against their opponents, to make you afraid. And you can go through all the people that used appeals to racial solidarity or appeals to fear and security. And in many ways, the best lessons I've gotten in my political career came from losing to Sharp James.
First time around.
Yes, first time around.
You've known the Kushner family for an awfully long time. How has your
20 years?
How has your view of that family evolved?
Look, this is deeper in many ways than that for me, and it is a test in many ways for the principles with which I live my life. So, when I needed to pass criminal justice reform and was negotiating to get that bill done, I'm proud to have led that in the United States Senate on the Democratic side. I still remember the battle to get the last thing I was trying to force into this bill, which was a ban on solitary confinement for juveniles. I was negotiating with Jared Kushner, who I've known since I think he was 11, 12, 13 years old.
Right. And just so the listeners know, the Kushner family has a real estate business not far from Newark.
No, but yeah. I think
they're more in Manhattan.
I think the better thing to know is that this was one of the biggest Democratic Party. They were
fundraisers.
They were fixtures.
Gave money to your campaigns?
Gave money to every major Democrat in America.
Right.
They were number one on the DNC list. Right. That's just a significant Democratic Party, a set of people. But my experience with them was very different. When the whole state establishment was going in a different direction, I had a meeting years ago, 2001 maybe, with Charlie Kushner, and he said—
Jared's father,
and he just said, I hear a lot about this guy. Tell me who you are. And he must have sat there and listened to me for 20, 30 minutes. And the more I talked, though, the more I thought this meeting is going wrong.
It was going wrong in what sense?
Because he looked so angry. as I was talking to him.
Just in general.
Yeah. And then at the end of the meeting, he just looks now like he's done with me. And he pushes some button or makes some call to his assistant and says, send in my business partners. And they sat down and he goes to them, we are about to make a really bad business decision. But this guy is a righteous man. And the guy he's running against is a blankety blank blank. And he goes, I'm going to support you. And I want you to tell people I am. And it did hurt him because Sharp James blocked his appointment to the Port Authority and a lot of other things. Again, this is decade plus before what we know now. And I still remember when he got into his legal trouble. When you are in trouble in life and you've done things wrong, I just will never sanction bad behavior and I will speak up against it. I don't care who you are. But I still remember still talking to him in prison and writing letters with him. And when he came out, I credit him with being a guy that was so moved by what he saw in the criminal justice system that we went together to, this is again, way before.
You saw salvation in them, in a sense.
He took me to Rikers Island.
You're talking about Charlie Kushner or Jared Kushner?
Jared's a kid, frankly.
Okay.
Takes me to Rikers Island and I meet with young black men to talk to them. And I still remember going around, how long you've been here, 6 months, a year, more, not even had your trial yet. And I was so angry when I walked out of there that it fueled me even more in my quest to end solitary confinement. And fast forward all the way to me arguing with Jared Kushner about ending that practice that I saw with his father, solitary confinement. And by the way—
Did that feel weird to you that you're negotiating with Jared Kushner, the son-in-law?
So at the end of the day, I'm a person of faith. And
and practicality.
Look, there's a Jewish phrase, gamzal tova. In everything, there is some purpose.
Good, yes,
some good. And so I don't question where God puts me sometimes, but I know I'm there for a purpose. And I don't know about this. Like, this is the stuff of a novel to have me now, the rivals, so to speak, in everything I'm trying to stop in the Trump administration. But vilification of individuals wholesale. Like, you know, Lindsey Graham and me, like, God, I could write a dissertation on my disagreements with Lindsey Graham. But when it came to that negotiating that criminal justice bill, he was on my side. I still remember him saying to the White House, give Cory Booker whatever he wants because you can't get this bill done without him. And so we are in this moment in American history where I'm hurting and I'm angry. But I will not fall into the trap, as my parents taught me, as my mom in Sunday school taught me, never let somebody pull you so low as to hate them.
But this is interesting. You were really rough on Joe Biden, totally understandably, about his relationship or the way he described his relationship with some segregationist
senators. No. It was more than that.
You could find some common ground and all the rest. You were really rough on him.
But that wasn't the reason.
Go ahead.
Because I think it's just that's some misreporting.
So what I'm saying is, how do you deal with people that are colleagues of yours in the Senate who in some form or another you consider modern segregationists?
Yeah. You
or do you not?
No. You have to work with people who you fundamentally disagree with.
But you're not disagreeing with them on the margins of a tax policy debate. You're fundamentally, morally, viscerally.
Donald Trump signed my bill. I worked with him and his White House to pass a bill that liberated thousands of black people from prison. When we took the crack cocaine, powder cocaine disparity that they moved from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1, which is still offensive and, in my opinion, racist, they didn't make it retroactive. The bill we got done made it retroactive, liberated thousands of people, 90% of them were black. So tell that liberated person that Cory Booker should not deal with somebody that he fundamentally disagrees with on more things. That's the problem in this country because, look, Chris Christie, who I disagree with on a lot of things, he's not a racist in any way, but he's a friend and I disagree with him passionately, but he was the governor of the state. We had to find common ground. He told me the story about how he lost 10 points in New Hampshire when he was running for president. Not any policy issue. They super PACs against him kept running a commercial of him hugging Barack Obama.
After the flood.
But think about this for a second. We're at a point in our country where hugging another human being, just touching somebody that's not in your tribe, we vilify each other so much. I felt this in a lesser way when I hug John McCain on the Senate floor. And the backlash on Twitter from people in my party for hugging a quote-unquote baby killer was what some of the comments, outrageous comments were.
How often do you look at Twitter?
I mean, now I don't. Honestly, I look at the tweets. I used to live on it. It was a platform with which I used constructively to help my city.
What drove you away? Was there a morning that you went on and you saw something that just said, you know what, I think I'm not going to swim in these waters anymore?
I think energy is so important. and my own energy
was sapped by it, yeah.
Was just drained by it.
Yeah.
I think it's the challenge with people who are in law enforcement and others. If you're, it is, you need to do something to protect your spirit and your soul.
Senator Cory Booker, thank you.
Thank you very
good
much.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Cory Booker is a candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2020, and he's currently the junior senator from the state of New Jersey. We spoke last week. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One of the biggest movies at the box office, and it's been highly anticipated by film buffs as well, is called Ad Astra. It's a space epic about an astronaut played by Brad Pitt who goes on a mission into space to stop a cataclysm that could threaten life on Earth. It's the kind of big-budget sci-fi adventure you'd more expect to see from J.J. Abrams or James Cameron. But Ad Astra was created by a director named James Gray, a very different kind of filmmaker. James Gray is known for intimate, small-scale dramas, many set in the outer boroughs of New York City, where he grew up. When Gray announced that his next film would be set in outer space, some of his admirers were a little puzzled, maybe concerned, and among them was Richard Brody, who covers film for NewYorker.com.
The first film of James Gray's that I saw was The Yards, which I saw on VHS tape, but I didn't have a DVD player yet, around 2005, 2006. It's about two young men, played by Joaquin Phoenix and Mark Wahlberg, who get caught up in a scandal involving organized crime, the MTA, and the Queensboro government.
Where are we going?
We're going to the Sunnyside Yards. The guys will be there, they're waiting for us. And there's someone new I want you to meet that's working with me now.
What are we gonna do down there?
We take out our competitors' trains.
You know, I had heard that he was a kind of hard-nosed realist, maybe in the early Martin Scorsese vein, and I didn't quite agree. James Gray's films look normal. He tells clear, straightforward chronological stories in which characters' motives are clearly set out. But the undertone is like the magma of a volcano. I often describe them as operatic. It's like actually watching an opera in the sense that the surfaces are extremely stylized and extremely controlled, but the emotional world is eruptive.
Control, I'm seeing a power surge on C-Post. You getting that?
Roger that, Roy.
Control, we got a lot of people up there. Over.
Control, I think we have information. Stand by, we're working the issue. Stand by.
I first heard about Ad Astra a couple of years ago, and I confess that I worried. I worried about the idea of a filmmaker whose movies were anchored so deeply in material reality, making a movie on a subject of which he has no physical experience. Fortunately, I was absolutely wrong.
You know, Stanley Kubrick once said that trying to direct a movie is like trying to write War and Peace in a bumper car in Coney Island.
I spoke with James Gray last week, just before the opening of Ad Astra.
And I think that when you deal with a certain scale, it only magnifies that problem. You have to find a way to clear out the room for the intimacy, to get a window into the person's soul. And the machinery gets in the way.
You know, in a way, this film is not a two-hander, it's a one-hander. It's very much a one-person alone in outer space film getting very deep into his own psyche.
Yeah, I'm guilty as charged. There's no other really major roles in the film, and obviously that was intended. I had read an article about the planned Mars mission. It said they're going to have four people for 2 years who are going to be in an area which is scarcely that much larger than the room we're in now, and we're in a pretty small room. So I thought, well, that's interesting. Usually when you see space movies with a team, they're always high-fiving each other and everyone's really excited to be there. And I thought, well, no, their perfect astronaut is actually someone who doesn't really want to talk to anyone else.
When I found out that you were making a science fiction film, I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it. I worried. And the reason I worried is that I said to myself, you know, you've been to Queens.
Well, I haven't just been to Queens. I've sort of set up shop and manufactured a bunch of things in Queens.
Right. You've been that there's something to be said for firsthand experience, any filmmaker's firsthand experience.
I was just trying to be as autobiographical as I could.
Yeah.
Which, may I say, is not the same thing as being personal. They're very different.
How do you see the difference?
I think autobiographical is you're adhering to the facts of your life. Personal means you're doing a kind of emotional deep dive. So, for example, I regard Ad Astra as very personal to me, but obviously I'm not going to Neptune. So it's really about what the film is about, what you're dealing with under the surface, and how you try to connect to the character or to the story. You're trying to get as intimate as possible. The most accurate rendition of your most intimate ideas and feelings and impressions. Almost a form of psychoanalysis, you know?
This is Major Roy McBride. I'm attempting to reach Dr. Clifford McBride. This is Dr. McBride's son. Dad, I'd like to see you again.
Movies like 2001 and Apocalypse Now are obvious points of reference for Ad Astra. And directors like Kubrick and Coppola, along with Scorsese and Cassavetes, loom large in Gray's work. But as someone who grew up in New York going to repertory cinemas, he had an unusually wide and unusually deep exposure to the history of cinema.
I saw Audette when I was like 14. I mean, no one I went to film school with had seen Audette. Audette, Carl Dreyer, what is that? Day of Wrath, and I'd seen all that stuff. And maybe I didn't get it fully. But that's okay. I had it at least to refer to it, you know?
Did this help you, hinder you in film school?
It hurt me in film school. I'll tell you, it hurt my ego. My ego was way too big. I thought I was fantastic. I thought I was fantastic all through the making of my first film. You know, I got that made. I was only 23 years old. I was incredibly lucky. I was just throwing my crumbs on the water and back were sprouting these incredible beautiful lilies. I thought, I'm a genius. I can do anything. It's amazing. And March 5th, 1994 happened, Richard Brody.
March 5th, 1994 was the day that James Gray first saw the footage that he had made cut together as a film.
And I walked in, and I thought, I'm going to see something great because I'm a genius. And it was the biggest piece of shit I ever saw in my life. And my ego has never recovered. And ever since, I've always felt that I'm trying to salvage what I can from an experience as opposed to moving triumphantly to do the next great movie. That is gone.
In point of fact, Little Odessa is a really terrific movie, and it was very well received. But James Gray was looking at his work in the context of the directors he reveres. And compared to Coppola or Ford or Hitchcock, well, of course his first film didn't measure up. But it did nonetheless feel like it belonged in the same tradition. And actually, when producers have come to him expecting him to make classic-style Hollywood movies, his work has often proved too idiosyncratic, too unusual. For example, his second movie, The Yards. The producers wanted a traditional crime movie with a redemptive ending, but that's not the personal story Gray wanted to tell. The production turned troubled, and as a result, the film was scantily released.
You know, it's very, very hard to keep an even keel because there's a level of public humiliation that goes along with it. You know, your friends, whom you love, remind you of it in the worst way. They'll send you the bad reviews. They'll say to you, well, when's your film coming out? Even though it came out 2 weeks ago, you know. And the experience I've had has been very difficult to get other films made.
I remember when Two Lovers was supposed to come out in Oscar season, and instead it was brought out in February and only in a few theaters. And then, forgive me for saying this, but Joaquin Phoenix, who was a favorite actor of mine, instead of going to promote the film on television, promoted his documentary and his
yes, indeed,
performance
he did.
Art.
Well, I mean, I love Joaquin to death, and I think he's a great, great, great actor, and I love him as a person. But the David Letterman show that he did was to promote Two Lovers, and nobody talked about the film. It was just complete nonsense what he did.
Can you set up the clip for us, Joaquin?
Are you serious? Just the maniacal laughter? I don't know what the clip is.
Don't know what the clip is? It's you and maybe you and a scene with you and Gwyneth Paltrow.
All right, you're doing fine.
Thanks. High praise coming from you.
Is that really?
We're having fun.
Is that? That's
fun? We're having fun. Just relax.
I said to myself, what the hell is he doing? He's killing the film.
And I loved his work in it. I thought he did himself a disservice. I thought he was beautiful in it.
In Two Lovers, James Gray got deeply personal. I can't speculate on whether it has any relation to the specifics of his own life, but the emotional tone of the film is deeply personal. And I think that at that point, in order to make films that were even more personal, he had to move away from his own specific place and time. That's why Ad Astra is such a remarkable achievement. He reaches very deep subjectivity in deep space.
This was a very, very hard movie to do. Took years out of my life. And I don't know what I want to do next. I just don't. I have an inkling. You know, there's a kind of almost autobiographical thing I'm thinking of doing about my high school, my transition years from public school to private. Let's just say Fred Trump was a major figure in my private school life. His son, Mr. Donald Trump. I think that political power, the underpinnings of where we are now, I think I'd like to talk about a little bit.
James Gray may not direct the next Marvel super spectacle, but by going back home, he may be expanding his canvas to the country and the world at large. Leave it to him to put a new spin on a classic idea. The personal is political.
The writer and director, James Gray. His movie Ad Astra, starring Brad Pitt, is in theaters now. And he talked with Richard Brody of The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Please stick around because just ahead, we've got a performance from a young British artist who merges music and poetry in a way that's pretty extraordinary. That's next.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. obvious, but with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Brianna Younger covers music for the section of the magazine we call Goings On. And so she knows every single cool thing happening around the city in the musical world, and I'm exaggerating only a little bit. Brianna, you talked recently with an artist named Kate Tempest, who performed a couple of songs for us. Who is Kate Tempest, and how did you hear about her?
Well, Kate Tempest is, you know, well, she does a little bit of everything. She's a poet, a musician, a playwright, a novelist. I personally first encountered her work on an NPR Tiny Desk a few years back.
Kate Tempest has been nominated for a lot of prizes as a recording artist, and she's really acclaimed in the more traditional poetry world. How unusual is that?
It's fairly unusual, but it also makes perfect sense. She's had a lot of success in both worlds, and she's, you know, an interesting and an intriguing artist.
Europe is lost, America lost, London lost. Still we are clamoring victory. All that is meaningless rules. We have learned nothing from history. The people are dead in their lifetimes, dazed in the shine of the street.
What kind of music scene does she come out of?
Well, she's from Southeast London, and when I talked to her, she told me this really great story about growing up in the dub rave scene and going to these all-night parties with these massive sound systems.
You know, you go there and 10, 11 o'clock at night, and when you come out, it's the day. And
she's
just spent the whole night like in this completely other dimension of possibilities and sound. And you come out and your ears are ringing, and your ears are screaming for days. So it's worth it, you know. I feel so blessed to have grown up there. I don't know why I'm in such a good mood. I think it's the jet lag, you know.
Kate Tempest's recent album is called The Books of Traps and Lessons. Great title. And it was produced by the ubiquitous Rick Rubin, probably the most famous record producer alive right now. Does that surprise you? Because it would seem like music here takes a backseat to the poems.
Rick Rubin has always been a really searching, curious musical figure, and he's worked across so many genres. So I'm not super surprised. And maybe that's because I've heard the result. They worked really well together.
I didn't ever imagine I would work with him, really. It's not something that I would really allow myself to think. But yeah, he reached out and basically he wanted me to stop locking in with the beat and to just go at the integrity of the lyric, let the lyric lead the voice all the time, follow the meaning. What happened with Rick is that he came on board as like a guide. Yeah, he came to listen, and the way that he listens is so intense. It's like the whole room transforms. It's like almost terrifying. You can hear absolutely every flaw in your performance. You can hear all the possibilities as well that you didn't pursue. And he just sits and he listens, and then he gives great advice, and he encourages certain elements of the demos and he discourages others. And it was pretty challenging, but it was really cool.
You have one track titled Fire Smoke. That was the first single you released in May.
It probably was May, but I don't. I think that this song is a nice one to just take out of the context because it is such a simple expression of a very beautiful sentiment. You know, it's a love song, and it's in many ways it's as simple as that. You know, it's just me, or it's the speaker of the poems declaring very simple truths about somebody they love very much. You know. Visionary is a vision. I watch her dance. by the window, and it rips my flesh to ribbons. And the whole world is just ripples in the middle distance. I listen to her hips, I push my kisses to her lips. We move like we were born to move. The night is teeth and pistons, and there is something in this tenderness that makes me want to live and live and live.
You kind of hesitated introducing it to allude to it being autobiographical, but is it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's definitely autobiographical. But it's, sometimes it's just easier when I'm talking about the album to say the speaker of the poems. I was thinking about this, like, you know, just because I'm in a place where I'm not from, just got to New York and I'm looking around, and I was thinking, like, you know, what right have I got to imagine that I have got anything to say that would resonate with anybody, you know, from here? Like, what can I tell any of these people about life? I know nothing. I'm so ignorant about everything, you know. But then the flip side of that is that if you pay very close attention to your own experience and you're very truthful in your creativity about what is happening within you, then something in that can resonate with the truthful experience within somebody else. And if you take the I completely out of it, then it's like you've got nothing to offer. There's no mutual offering. Basically, all this to say, it made me realize that there's kind of no shame in just saying, well, look, here's some songs, here's a piece of poetry about some things that I have been through, and I hope that they connect and resonate with some things that you've been through. And who knows, you know? Free me, untangle the madness that knots me. You drop to your knees, you crawl across me, you lick your lips softly. This fire smoke. The fire. And love is redemptive in this process, because it's like the kind of final frontier. You can imagine that you've learned all the lessons, that you know all there is to know about your own behavior. But then when you're in a relationship with somebody else, that's when you really see your faults. That's why it's so hard. You know, because that's when you really come up against your pettiness and your inability to live the way that you want to live. You can't, you know, so many people that talk the talk about, you know, positivity and all this, they know they're so enlightened, you know, they know all this stuff, but in the reality of their relationships, are they allowing themselves to raise their voices to the people closest to them, their children, their partners, their parents, you know?
Is this how it feels to feel certain? For so many years, my love's been a burden. But now comes this fire to cleanse and restore us, to fuel us and calm us and push us both forward.
It took you 5 years to work through this process and to release the album. What kind of seeds are you planting, both for yourself as a creative person, but also, you know, what kind of seeds are you hoping to plant in listeners, and how do they align with your own personal creative evolution?
That's such a good question. My hope for any of my output is a hope for connection. Because I believe that connection is the antidote to numbness. Numbness is a requirement of the times in which we live, and is in many ways the enemy of creativity. But it's essential that we're numb in order to survive. And for me, when I am at my most numb, it's music that brings me out of it and reinvigorates me and reconnects me with my life, you know, my lifeness, my livingness. Because if you connect fully with your own experience, you hear something in an album that makes you think about some moment in your life, it just takes you further into the present. And then that enables you to actually check in with other people's present, you know, and actually be closer to other people's experience.
And that's the perfect introduction, I think, to your last track with us, People's Faces, which it's one of the more, I think it wraps up the album nicely on a nice, hopeful, like, connective note.
The album closes with the words, "I love people's faces." Literally, I couldn't put it any truer than that. And it's a profound thing for me in my life. Every day I have a moment where I'm like, "Wow, people's faces are so beautiful." You know, it's like, it's the kind of truest line I've ever written, I think.
Love it. Thank you.
Thank
if you would like to take us home.
I came to under a domed roof. The light was cold and clear and fragmented. There were people moving. I watched them. I saw a muscle of schoolgirls performing. I saw the ticket woman massaging the small of her back. I saw the young gent as neat as a crease in his work clothes. And I saw the light. It was as light as breath on a dirty old track. It's coming to pass. My country's coming apart. The whole thing's becoming such a bumbling farce. Was that a pivotal historical moment we just went stumbling past? I don't know. But here we are, dancing in the rumbling dark. So please, come a little closer. Give me something real that I can grasp. Give me your beautiful, crumbling heart. Another disaster, catharsis, another half-discarded mirage, another mask slips. I face off with the physical. My head is ringing from the love of the stars. There is too much pretense here. Too much depends on the fragile wages and the extortionate rents here. We are working every dread day that is given us, feeling like the person we could be. It really isn't us, like we're gonna buckle underneath the trouble, like any minute now our struggles are going to finish us. And then we smile at all our friends. It's hard. We got our heads down and our hackles up, our backs against the wall. I can feel you aching. None of this was written in stone. There is nothing we're forbidden to know. And I can feel things changing. Even when I'm weak and I'm breaking, I stand weeping at the train station, 'cause I can see your faces. So much peace to be found in people's faces. I saw it roaring and I felt it clawing at my clothes like a grieving friend. It said there are no new beginnings until everybody sees that the old ways need to end. But it's hard to accept that we are all one and the same flesh, given the rampant divisions between oppressor, complicit and oppressed. But we are, though, more empathy, less greed, more respect. All I've got to say has already been said. I mean, you heard it from yourself when you were lying in your bed and you couldn't sleep, thinking, couldn't we be doing things differently? I'm listening to every little whisper in the distance, singing hymns, and I can feel things changing. I can feel things changing, but it's hard. We've got our heads down and our hackles up, our backs against the wall, man. I can feel your heart racing. None of this was written in stone. The currents fast, but the river moves slow, and I can feel things changing. Even when I'm weak and I'm breaking, I stand weeping at the train station, 'cause I can see your faces. There's so much peace to be found in people's faces. But it's not enough to imagine we'll be happy when we've got enough stuff. All this stuff is blocking us. I'm neat with no chaser. I'm all spirit, but I am sinking, because my days are not days, but strange symptoms. And this age is our age, but our age is rage, sinking to beige. And yes, our children are brave, but their mission is vague. Is a life well lived, or is a life well displayed? I don't have the answers, but I believe there are still things to say. I stare out at my city on another difficult day, and I scream inwardly, man, when will this change? I'm beginning to fade, but my sanity saved, 'cause I can see your faces. It's hard. We got our heads down and our hackles up, our backs against the wall, man, I can feel your heart racing. None of this was written in stone. The current's fast, but the river moves slow, and I can feel things changing. Even when I'm weak and I'm breaking, I stand weeping at the train station, 'cause I can see your faces. There is so much peace to be found in people's faces. I love people's faces.
Kate Tempest performing People's Faces at WNYC. Claire Uchima was accompanying her, and Tempest spoke with Brianna Younger of The New Yorker. Tempest is on tour right now, and she's got a few more dates in the U.S. before heading overseas. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the show today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Cuadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kella Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Meng-Fei Chen and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.